following is an audio recording of the testimony from Dr. Murray Strauss to the New Hampshire Commission on the Status of Men. This testimony is from the June 30th, 2006 meeting of the Commission held in the Legislative Office Building in Concord, New Hampshire. Dr. Strauss is co-chair of the University of New Hampshire's Family Research Laboratory, located in Durham, New Hampshire. He was invited to speak to the Commission on the issue of domestic violence. Members of the Commission who were present at this meeting include Chair Dr. Joe Mastro-Marino, Scott Garman, Michael Janulis, Marshall Hickok, and David Lauren. This audio recording is in the public domain and may be copied and redistributed without permission.
So it's a pleasure to be here and be able to share some of the results of my research with the commission. I believe that I was asked to say something about the recently presented piece of research. It was presented at a conference in New York City a few weeks ago, and that's what this handout is about. And also to say something about criticisms of that study and of the conflict tactic scale, which is the instrument used to measure violence in partner relationships in this study and in hundreds of other studies. The handout that you have is unedited from what I presented in New York, except I inserted on the first slide that I'm presenting it here also, and I realized as I looked through this before, just a few minutes before coming in here, that there are certain slides that I could have and should have made more directly relevant for considerations of the status of men. And there's so much in this study that what you bring out depends on the interests of the audience. So when I get back to Durham, I will revise some of these slides to point out their implications for the status of men specifically. These are the ones at the end. Well,
would you be willing to send them in email form?
Yes, I'll send them to the whole commission. If the secretary could send me an email with all the addresses, then I can click reply all, and everyone will get it.
I would just like to ask. I can see your rather soft-spoken, and since we have a member of the media here, I just wanted to know whether if she was having difficulty hearing, would the commission grant her permission to sit at the table to be able to hear a little more easily if she's having difficulty? Are you having difficulty hearing? Or
I can hear okay.
And I'll try and speak a little louder also. Thank you.
Sorry to interrupt.
No. This particular paper is one of a whole series coming out of the study that I organized starting 5 years ago called the International Dating Violence Study. And we only just this last April finished gathering all the data from the 32nd and last of the countries in the study. It covers many things. The issues that I'm going to talk about this afternoon are in slide 3. The slide numbers are in the lower right corner of each slide. The first issue is whether, and incidentally, I would be very pleased to have any questions raised as I go along, rather than waiting until the end. I think it's more helpful that way, or comments, what have you. So the issues in slide 3. As given in slide 3 here. First is partner violence primarily perpetrated by men as compared to women and as compared to both partners engaging in violence. And second, to what extent is dominance by the male partner associated with partner violence as compared to dominance by the female partner? In short, is the issue one of male dominance or one of inequality between partners? And the answers to those questions can have some profound implications for prevention and treatment of partner violence, as I'll try and show at the end. Well, I won't spend the Commission's time with the details of the International Dating Violence Study, except to say that as in addition to the 32 nations, there are 68 students at 68 universities. Now, it's important to remember that this is a study of university students and their dating relationships, not a study of married couples. All studies that have compared general population couples with student couples find anywhere from three to five times higher rates among university students than in the general population. Why is that? I like to think it's not because they're my students. It's because they're young. And the few of those same studies that have compared married couples of the same age, 18 to 21, 22, find slightly higher rates. In other words, young people in couple relationships, as in almost all other relationships, all other aspects of life, are on average more likely to engage in violence. Yes?
I'm sorry, Professor.
Sure.
Marshall Hickok.
Yes.
Sort of,
hi.
Taking you up on your invitation to ask questions.
Great.
And I'm looking at the issues, and I've followed your reports a little bit, and I've heard questions raised about methodology and so forth. So it seems like an appropriate time to ask. And it's really a several-part question, and it has to do a bit with methodology. Would you agree or disagree or maybe comment on the extent to which your statistics rely on self-reporting, whether you agree or disagree that men are more equally or less likely to report domestic violence, and to what extent, if any, that has an impact on your conclusion?
Okay. This study does rely on self-report. This is not something that one can hang out in a house and wait for the chance to observe it. Though when I used to do laboratory experimental studies, when I had husband, wife, and one or two of the kids in to work on a task, I did, out of the 250-odd couples I studied in that way, there were two instances in which I did see it. One husband said to his wife, "You got to match the colors, you dummy," and he kicked her. But it's very rare, and that was an experiment in which the participants were under some stress and time pressure, intentionally. So it does rely on self-report, which primarily means that what I'm giving you is underestimates of the true number. A lot of violence is sort of one of those, okay, you take the good with the bad, or the bad with the good. It's part of life. It's maybe a lousy part, and people forget about it. When I have done detailed time point by time, okay, let's go through from picking some time points, say from New Year's Day to now. Let's go through each month. I get much higher rates than in these mass surveys. These are minimal estimates. As are all other data. For example, police data, police crime, FBI crime data, at best uncover about 1/80th of the total number, because it takes special circumstances for a case to come to the attention of the police. Someone needs to be injured, or there needs to be a big enough ruckus that the neighbors call, or drunkenness is involved, and other disturbances of the peace acts. So the police get a tiny fraction of the total, and they get an unrepresentative sample. Every one of these methods has its limitations and its advantages. I mean, for example, the police, they represent very policy important cases, because those are the police's requiring public services, and are among the most serious instances of violence. But it's a tiny fraction of the total, an important fraction, though. Now, as far as do men report more or less, they report about the same. There have been perhaps between 10 and 15 studies which have compared. And three of those studies show that men underreport. So you get an understatement according to three of the studies. But according to the other 10, they're about equal. So the critics of these techniques, of course, mention only the three that are the other way, because this is not, this research is not pure science. It overlaps with social movements and social policy efforts, and therefore it's legitimate for them. It's not legitimate for scientists. It's legitimate for someone trying to get a legislator to act to bring out the aspect of the case that makes their case. That's the way these things work. But it works somewhat differently in science. Does that deal with your...
It does, but just to somewhat summarize and confirm, when we say self-reporting, are we talking about responses to surveys, inquiries that you've generated, or are we talking about to the authorities or a combination?
Oh, I'm sorry, I misunderstood you. I took the term self-report to mean in research, reporting in response to questions in an interview, either a survey interview or an in-depth individual interview. Now, of course, the police don't have to depend entirely on self-report. They can see some things, but they depend on self-report for different accounts, which are often very divergent of the different parties involved.
Would you agree there's a general perception that men are less likely to report domestic violence than women?
They're less likely to publicly report, that is, to police or to agencies, their own victimization. There are two or three studies which show this. They're less likely to report their own victimization, in part because they don't think people are going to believe them. A real man shouldn't have this happen to him. And in part because it's shameful. As part of their own self-image. The women's movement faced the identical thing in the 70s. They had to wage a major campaign to get women to overcome their reluctance to file a police report, and they, to a considerable extent, they were successful. That was directed only at women. No one has waged a campaign to get men to come forward when they are victimized. And in fact, despite very strenuous and to a considerable extent successful efforts by police in many jurisdictions, not all, but in many jurisdictions, to have male victims treated equally with female victims, there are lots of instances, I keep reading case after case, in which the police treat it as a joke or as something you should be able to handle. So they would not dream of saying that to a woman, thanks to the efforts of the women's movement. Now we need an effort to make the same thing apply to male victims, and that's not presently occurring.
Can you expand on that last comment, things that as that in part is precisely what this commission is tasked was doing. Can you sort of share your thoughts on how men might be encouraged to respond?
Well, in the same way as the women's movement got women to do that through public service announcements, through training of police officers, through revisions of police manuals, many of them all on domestic violence, line by line referred to the offender in the male, what he did, and the victim, she. So to change that to say women and men, men and women. Just 2 days ago, I only saw the tail end of it, or I would have copied it down. There was a public service announcement on television, one of the morning TV shows, an anti-violence, and it showed a young man, and it said that that this is addressed to the young men of America. We have to learn how to deal with things non-violently, as though women never did this. But that's an example of the continuing effectiveness of the women's movement on this, which I laud. But there needs to be also an effectiveness to make it apply to men and to women when women are in the perpetrator role. So public education is not an area that I have much expertise, so I may not have too many details, but I think public service announcements, posters. University of New Hampshire just this fall had a wonderful poster series on partner violence, and in each of them it was the male offender, totally ignoring the fact that the very people who published these posters in one of their own studies found equal rates between men and women. This goes on all the time. People just ignore what they don't want to see. Yes?
Yeah, I mean, that raises a question, I think. I'm a former student at the University of New Hampshire. I graduated in 2003, and I saw many of the same things going on at UNH when, ironically, you're one of the leading recognized researchers who have shown this, that domestic violence is not so much of a gender issue. Have you been involved on any input when these groups that are generating these posters and awareness information?
No. No, I have not.
Have you tried to become involved in any of that? Or?
No, I haven't. It is partly my fault. I'm a researcher, not an advocate, though of course I have clear opinions on things and I know what I do advocate, but that isn't what I spend my time doing. I spend my time doing research and teaching. So I think if I had come forward and said, if I knew about it, which I didn't even know about it, if I knew about it and come forward and said I'd like to be on this, at least at the university, I would have been welcomed, but not at some other venues. Yes.
Mr. Strauss, I'm interested in the methodology of your studies. What do you ask a series of questions to participants and to gauge, violent behavior that they have engaged in or what they consider to be violent behavior?
Yes.
Would you be willing to provide the commission with a copy of of the questions that are asked?
Yes. Some of them are actually in this handout. I hope. No, but I will. So, oh yes, they are. They are in slide 8 on the second page, upper right side. Those are the questions from the conflict tactic scale, the instrument that I developed in the 1970s and has been used in hundreds of studies around the world and has demonstrated its validity and dependability over and over again. It's also been declared by people who don't like the results from this as invalid and undependable over and over again, but without evidence. Just they don't like the results, so therefore it can't be right.
Does this take into account or look into the purposes that people use for violence? Because if we're talking about domestic violence, if we're talking about, if we're just talking about this in terms of are we a violent society? You know, I think everyone would agree that this is a somewhat violent society. But if we are using it to show that there is an equal amount of domestic violence, actions that could be considered to be domestic violence related perpetrated by women as opposed to that perpetrated by men, are we taking into account the purpose?
Well, that's up to each investigator to do. Just as if I were to have a certain heart condition, that's then up to the physician to try and figure out why I have that, and that requires separate tools. Or if you're in education and you have kids with poor reading ability, you don't want the reading test to be a test of why they have poor reading ability. You have to investigate that and also look at the consequences. Poor reading can seriously handicap a child subsequently in all of life. So that needs to be investigated to determine the extent to which poor reading by itself does that. Now, in my research, and in this particular research, we have in detail investigated causes, and that's the part of one aspect of that is in this paper, namely dominance. Is violence used to dominate the other partner? And it is. It's only one of many causes, only one of many, but it's an important one. My feminist critics, incidentally, I think of myself as a feminist, even though I'm an excommunicated feminist, but like many other excommunicated people, I remain faithful to feminism in the sense of equality, not feminism in the sense of women above all, any more than I'm in favor of men above all. I think each side should be treated fairly, each gender, and that's what one of the jobs of this commission is, at least that's what I have inferred. So we have investigated injury as a consequence, we've investigated dominance as a cause, and many other causes. That's an important part of the research program. The difference between my research and that and the non-research of my critics is that they don't do empirical investigations. They establish these things by fiat. That's the way it is. And that's the way it should be. That's the way it is. I don't know if that dealt with your question.
No. I guess what I'm... we don't have all of your questions here, but you ask, do you consider yelling at somebody? Is that one of the...
No, that's in the study, but it's not the measurement. I restrict violence to physical attacks. Okay. When I use the term violence, I mean physical attacks. If yelling, you lazy son of a bitch, what have you, that I call psychological aggression. And that, there's another scale that measures that. And there's a new scale that measures willingness and having negotiated and explained and reasoned. So many aspects of this are need to be considered. And we certainly haven't considered all of them, but we've considered more than anyone else, I would claim.
I think, I may interject, one of the things that I like about the way research tends to be going now is that it's looking beyond, like, you know, who hit who, you know, who, but looking at the causes. Like, one of the purposes behind this study seems to be looking at the issue of dominance, you know, and look at giving the same questions to both men and women, and analyzing the degree of dominance. There's certainly relationships where the female is the dominant, and there's one where the male may be dominant, and then looking at the causes or result of that. I mean, is someone being verbally aggressive and they're establishing some dominance and then causing some coercion in terms of the relationship or in terms of the conflict, how that couple resolves conflict versus, you know, a dominant situation where somebody, where there's no real, well, I would say no solution to conflict, somebody sort of is, you know, intimidating and coercive and they win on that basis. And I think that this, the handout which I gave you one of on the conflict tactics skills starts to address, some of that, some of those questions. And I think that this is really important in terms of the overall view, because we didn't get beyond, you know, the who did what, who yelled at who, but sort of looking at, you know, where the primary problem is. I mean, it's the primary problem is somewhere. It's a relationship problem that is not necessarily tied to, I think, gender. It's tied perhaps more to defects in, you know, dealing with conflict, in being able to assert yourself without being overwhelmed. Does that make sense?
It makes sense to me, except that I would add to that a qualification. There are some aspects that are tied to gender. One of them is injury. Attacks by men result in, on average, it depends on the study, but on average about a third, three times as much injury, three times the probability of injury that needs medical treatment as by women. Or you can put it the other way around, that women inflict one-third of the injuries from partner violence. Now, men inflict two-thirds, but we can't ignore the one-third. That's a very substantial percentage of the injuries, and it applies from everything from slaps to murder. Of partner homicides in the United States over the last 20 years, approximately a third have been perpetrated by women. So it's everything from slaps to murder. It's a serious health problem, a serious psychological problem, a serious threat to families and family life and the kind of families that we all want to see our fellow citizens enjoy.
Has there been a change over time with respect to, it's hard to know whether the reporting, the research has gotten better with respect to becoming aware of violence perpetrated by women, or whether there's been an increase in violence. And I'm wondering, is there any correlation between an increase in violence with the women's changing role in society?
Well, that's a much disputed issue among criminologists. There are criminologists who believe that the convergence, it's called the convergence theory, is going on, that as women gain equality, they are not only gaining equality in jobs, and income, positions on boards of directors, and so forth, but they're gaining equality in crime, in part because they have greater opportunity to commit certain kinds of crime. It's hard to embezzle from a corporation unless you're in a certain position in that corporation. If you're not there, you can't do it. The evidence for the United States is pretty mixed on it. You can interpret it either way. The evidence from my international study is consistent with the convergence theory. In societies where women have more equality, they do more crime. Slightly. It's not a big effect, but it's there. So does that mean we shouldn't have equality? No. It's one that any social change, no matter how desirable, has its positive aspects and its negative aspects. And equality for women, it's my interpretation of the evidence, which I say is quite mixed, but my interpretation is that it is having this, there is this convergence effect. This is for crime in general, I'm not talking about partner crime, partner violence.
Can you speak to partner violence in that context?
Yep. Yes, I can, because in the paper presented by one of my colleagues, a co-authored paper presented just a week ago at a conference, we show that the higher no, that's incorrect. It doesn't show that. So I don't have any clear evidence on that as yet. We're working on it. That aspect wasn't covered.
And let me just quickly ask you, do you feel, and I have my own views on the way the efforts of the Men's Commission have been reported in the press. Do you have any sense, or what is your sense of whether these issues are treated fairly in the media, or do you feel that there tends to be a kind of continuation of the view that there's a bit of incredulity that women would be violent, and there's some nerve suggesting that, and just generally, do you feel the issue is handled, how do you feel it's handled generally in the media?
Well, it's hard to disentangle how this issue is dealt with from the current mode of dealing with things. The current mode in the press is the kind of get both sides approach, which is in most ways very positive. But it gives equal weight to distinguished scientists who, for example, on the issue of evolution, and someone who has no scientific training saying that this evolution stuff is a lot of bunk. But they have to get the other side. On the other hand, I think it's worth putting up with that, to have this strategy that has evolved in the press of getting both sides, even when they're not equally credible, both sides. As I say, every social change, including desirable ones, and I think that is a desirable change in the news business, has its downside. And just to take, for example, the report on this study that was in some of the local newspapers. They presented my results quite well. Limited aspects of them, but quite well. That's all you can do in one article, is newspaper articles, limited aspect. And then, of course, they got people from the women's movement to comment on it, and they said, it's worthless. And I've answered some of those in the last two slides, on the very last page. As long as we're on that, if that's okay with the chairperson, I could. What's that?
I wanted to ask you a couple
yes.
of questions on the things that you brought up before.
Sure.
You talked about, based on your research, the incidence of violent acts by women, but do you ask, when somebody reports that they've done something, do you ever ask why? What was the context?
Frequently. Yes,
not
and other studies. Well, in this case, because I've done many studies of this since 1972. Different studies focus on different aspects. This study, for example, has data on dominance, and it has data on the certain aspects of the personality of the participants, criminal history, so forth. So in studies where that has been asked, not just mine, but 6 or 7 other studies, it's been found overwhelmingly that the most frequent proximate motivation is anger, frustration, correcting misbehavior, stop running around with other women. We've talked about this 100 times, and you don't pay any attention to me.
That was a sexist comment.
What's that?
Both parties,
yes, exactly. And he too, stop running around with other men. For both men and women, the proximate causes are about the same. For some things, they're different, the more distal causes. Like for men, heavy drinking is a more important cause than it is for women. It's a cause for both, but it's much more important for men, in part because men do a lot more heavy drinking. But if you take the proximate causes, what led to the immediate act, it's overwhelmingly, for both men and women, correcting misbehavior, anger over misbehavior, frustration, just wanting to punish the other person for hurts that have been imposed.
Do you get into how many of the instances are for protection or, in effect,
yes.
fighting back from, an initial act.
Yeah. In our last national survey in the United States, we asked who hit first. According to male respondents, in 52% of the cases, they hit first. According to female respondents, in 47% of the cases, they hit first. So that's almost identical. They're agreeing that that's, plus or minus 4 percentage points, which is within random error. So there was no difference in who hit first and initiating violence. And then in this study, we have, as you'll see, about 10, in the first row, this is summarizing it over all the nations in the study. In the three columns under mutuality type, male is the only one who hits 9.9% of the time. Female is the only one who hits 21% of the time. Both violent, that's where it primarily is, 66%. So at least for the part that's male only and female only, we know it can't be self-defense. And in general, studies that have more directly addressed self-defense have found that self-defense is rarely the precipitating cause for either men or women. It ranges, depending on the study, from 5% to 45%, but the typical figure in those studies is about 15%, and it's about equal for men and women. So most partner violence is not in self, 80% is not in self-defense. It's to correct misbehavior as perceived by the attacking partner and anger. And the percent in self-defense is about the same for men and women.
You mentioned a statistic about homicides and
yep.
that sort of thing, about a third being, I think you said,
Perpetrated by a female partner, two-thirds perpetrated by the male partner.
How do you correlate that then with the, I mean, that seems to fly in the face of the statistics and the latest domestic violence fatality review committee report for the state of New Hampshire, which shows that for the 14 years from 1990 to 2003, there were a total of 19 domestic violence-related homicides,
mm-hmm.
of which only one had a female perpetrator. 18 were perpetrated by men. So that seems to really fly in the face.
Yes,
of your,
it,
you know, so
it
how
does.
Do you reconcile
these,
that?
Well, these are national statistics from the FBI. Any one state can differ. Also, when you have an N of only 19, you can have random fluctuations. And it might be that if we had that data for the last 100 homicides, it would be quite different. It could be in agreement. I'm not saying it is, but it could be. But when you have only 19 cases, you cannot depend the margin of error of for that 1 out of 19 is greater than chance and is not statistically dependable.
Okay.
It's a fact. It's a fact that that's what has happened.
39. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, having been an assistant attorney general in Maine, I can tell you that, you know, in Maine, historically, from about 1995 through, well, when I left Maine in 2000, historically, more than at least 50% of all homicides were domestic violence related. And of the ones that were domestic violence related, I don't recall any that were perpetrated by the by the woman, by the who was the victim in all of them. So I find you say that those are statistics from the FBI?
Yes. And
I
can send those to you if you'd
I'd
like.
I'd
yes.
like to see that.
So if you could remind me to send, I think there's now three things. I'm going to send a revision of this. I'm going to send the FBI statistics. And then I think there was
and
a third.
Also a copy of your survey, the actual survey, along with, if you could, I'd be very interested in the instructions that are given
sure.
to
I'll just send
the people administering it.
Yeah.
Commissioner Laura, maybe when we've exchanged email addresses, you could send a list of what you want to Professor Strauss so he's not tasked with keeping track of all these.
Sure. If you'd be willing to give us
sure.
your spot, business cards, yeah.
Yeah. If I may clarify on that figure 10 on page 39, there's three categories of homicide. One is partner, one is family member, and one is DV related. Under DV related is only one, but under family members is 7, and the partner is 10. These are female perpetrators of murder.
Right, but if you also look, Mike, under partner, while 10 female perpetrators, there were 65 male perpetrators out of a total of 75. And in family members, there were 7 female perpetrators 38 male perpetrators for a total of 45. So still, that's still not for one-third, two-thirds proportion. And that's why, I only cited the DV related because this seemed to be in the context of our conversation, seemed to be more in the context of domestic violence. But even carrying it all through, and I thank you for pointing that out, in terms of all three out of a total of 139 homicides, 18 were committed by women, 121 by men.
Yeah. If you take all homicides, women nationally commit only about 10% of them. But things are different in the family as they, in this respect, as they are in many other aspects. We want the family to be different, not in this way, but in other ways. Nationally, about a third are committed by women. So women rarely commit homicide, but when they do, it's a male partner much more often. And men, only a fraction of their homicides are of female partners. That's because they're killing everyone else. And so it comes out to be a small percentage of the total. Our part of the problem may be that we're a low homicide state. And what my research years ago, I used to do research on state-to-state differences in homicide. I found that the lower the homicide rate of a state, the bigger the percentage where it was within family. Not just partners, but parent, child, child, parent. I don't want to take the time to explain why that is, or the theory I put forward to explain why that is, but things are different in low homicide states than high homicide states, and this may be one of the things.
Can you comment on the extent to which an assertion of domestic violence is alleged to gain an advantage in litigation?
I don't have any experience with that. You know, I have read many times charges that this is used in that way, but I myself have never investigated it, so I can't speak with any kind of authority on it.
I can just make a quick comment, David. The numbers, in order to start to get anything that resembles statistical significance, like we have a real problem with medical control board and doing trauma surveys and stuff, because New Hampshire's a giant number. So you have to get numbers up on the 200, 300, 400 range before you can start to generate anything that's, you know, significant enough to be able to think about it. I mean, one of our big problems that we really couldn't come to any real conclusions because it was just such a small number for many of the studies we want to do in terms of, you know, will this cause accidents? You know, was this an effective way? You know, you're better off sending people to the trauma center versus the local hospital first, and things like that. Just, you know, if you don't have, you know, that total of 18 or 20 or, you know, 45, it's just too small number to really, you know, to really look at. I mean, if you look at it and say, well, gee, look at that, but you can't. You know, so to say so.
No, I agree. I mean, having done a lot of statistical studies as an educator myself, sometimes I think I should have stayed in education instead of becoming a lawyer.
If you can do all those statistics,
I should have used my master's in education more. But I agree that the larger your the population of the study is, the better. But, you know, it was just that in the context of what Professor Strauss said, you know, I wanted to ask in the context of how...
I think we got the professor off track here and after, like, the third slide, so...
I think this has been very productive. I think it's better to address issues
that... Like, what's that? I hope you didn't expect to come here going through things in order.
We figured this was just a fallback.
Nobody goes through things in order either.
But let me ask
it's important to address the issues that are on your minds. That's why you invited me here.
Well,
we're kind of desperately concerned in part with, you know, we were following the statistics of the, you know, disparate rates of admission and graduation at UNH, you know, the dropout rates in high school of boys, you know, you're probably familiar with the relatively now recent issue of Newsweek. Remember some weeks ago, months ago, had a cover story.
I didn't read that, but I'm familiar with the general issue.
Well, that, you know, seemed to give it some mainstream credibility, and, you know, they attribute, the bottom line in that article seemed to be lack of a strong father figure in the home. But you know, we're struggling with public initiatives, programs, courses, things that might, you know, start to change some of these things, and we're just curious about your thoughts on you know, what grade level seems intuitively like the earlier the better, but can you suggest some sort of, whether they're simple day-long, you know, assembly presentations or maybe even curriculum changes, things in the public schools that you might like to see, you know, offered in New Hampshire that might address some of these problems?
Well, I can't suggest it on the as far as the educational attainments of boys are concerned, because that's not something that I have expertise in. I can address it as far as domestic violence, partner violence goes, and that is many schools have violence prevention programs. But those programs consistently omit two things. Violence by girls. There are programs that don't, but I don't know if any are being used in New Hampshire.
I'm sorry?
Violence by girls. There are for high school students, there are violence prevention programs, including partner violence prevention programs. But they're almost all, with I know of one exception, there may be more, but overwhelmingly they are addressed to violence by young men, not violence by young women, which is just as frequent, or actually among young people more frequent than violence by young males. So the family life education and violence prevention programs ought to address women hitting, girls hitting their partners, just as they address boys hitting their partners. That's one thing. And the other thing, which probably relatively few people will agree with me on, is they should address parents spanking kids, parents hitting kids. If you look at slide number 29. And the slide numbers are in the lower right of each slide. That shows the amount of corporal punishment experienced as you go from left to right, and the percent who hit their spouse. This is from a nationally representative sample of American couples, and you can see the more these kids were hit, they're not kids, their average age was 40. This is their recalling being slapped or spanked by their parents when they were 13 or 14, which was the youngest age I felt I could get accurate recall data. And the more they were hit by the parents, the greater the percent who hit their partner as adults. The problem with using corporal punishment to correct misbehavior is that it establishes that it's morally right to hit someone who's misbehaving and persists in it, won't listen to reason, as parents are fond of saying, and as children are fond of doing, not listening to reason. So when you're married, the problem is, or dating, the problem is it's not only children don't listen to reason, it's all partners misbehave and don't listen to reason sooner or later as the other partner sees it. And when that happens, if you've been brought up that way, as most of us have, there's a greater probability of hitting a partner to correct their misbehavior, just as parents hit them to correct their misbehavior. Now, it's most don't do it, of course. It goes from even for kids who had the most corporal punishment as a child, it's about 25% who hit their partners as an adult, which means 75% didn't. But that's true of all epidemiological data. Of people who are heavy smokers, more than a pack a day, only, end quote, a third die of it. Two-thirds, which means that two-thirds of heavy smokers don't. And similarly, only 25% of kids who've been hit a lot by their parents hit their partner in the year we studied them. So all of these are probabilistic. They increase the probability of something. They increase the likelihood. They fortunately don't guarantee it.
This, to me, cast a new slant on what I'm used to hearing over the years, you know, the drumbeat about the cycle of violence directed towards men. If he was hit as a child, you know, he'd likely to do some hitting himself, with no reference to a woman being hit as a child, who might be doing a little hitting on her own when she gets to be an adult. But
it's the same as you saw.
I asked the question, and I think I already know the answer. The reason I ask it, it has to do with misplaced responsibility, let's call it. And that is, who's doing most of the hitting of the kids around the house?
Mothers do substantially more, not hugely more, but substantially more than fathers, primarily because mothers do more of the child care. They've got more hours of exposure to the kids. You go to a pediatrician's office, who do you see there with the kids? It's mothers, much more than fathers. Just to take that as one of many examples.
Is that an excuse or a reason?
It's an explanation. It's not a justification. Neither parent should do any hitting. My position, and what based on extensive research, of which this is the weakest of the research, it's just one that I got a hold of, we have longitudinal studies that have followed up kids for 2, 4, and 6 years, and deal with the methodological problems there of 4-year-olds, 6-year-olds, and 9-year-olds. And the results are parallel for those ages, though the greatest, ironically, the greatest adverse effect of spanking is hitting little kids. And I say ironically because that's when in our society, our culture says it's most, quote, appropriate to hit kids. It does the most damage with little kids, and bigger kids can take it better. That doesn't mean they should be hit. None of them should be hit. It's more effective in the long run, not necessarily in the immediate situation, to use non-violent modes of correction, discipline. We need. So, getting back to your question, and I guess this applies generally to boys and girls, but more to boys because mothers do more hitting than fathers, and boys get hit more than girls. Every study shows boys get hit more often than girls. And every study shows that being hit is bad for a child's mental health, reduces academic achievement. So it would help a lot of those issues if parents were nonviolent, just as we want us adults to be nonviolent. That doesn't mean no discipline. The problem in our country is that so many people equate discipline with hitting, with spanking. And discipline means correction of misbehavior, not hitting to do it. So,
have you reached any sort of overarching general conclusions, some takeaway messages that
you know, we view our mission, our charge here as on several levels, but, you know, one level recommending legislation, another raising public awareness. I'm just wondering if you have any kind of suggestions along those lines.
Well, maybe getting back to what I mentioned a minute ago, maybe the commission could look into the content of violence prevention programs in our schools and make sure that male victims are covered, not just female victims.
Have you ever looked at any of those programs?
I've not in New Hampshire. I've looked at a couple of programs, they are focused on girls, on boys as offenders, girls as victims, totally ignoring this overwhelming body of evidence. There's one program that I know of that doesn't, by Vanjie Foshee, F-O-S-H-E-E, that was sponsored by the development of that program was sponsored by the Centers for Disease Control. She's at the University of North Carolina Medical School. I've looked at that program. It's excellent. And it attends to both. So it could be that you could, especially since you have contacts in the education system, see what the content of those programs are. That's changeable. You're not going to get schools to go about telling in our culture today to go about telling parents not to spank their kids, but if we want to have a less violent and more productive and healthy society, that's one of the steps that is going eventually will come about and has come about in some countries. Sweden, for example, banned all use of corporal punishment by parents in 1979. And as part of the civil code, there's no criminal penalty. I would be opposed to it if there were criminal penalties. And the Swedish approach is to regard parents who are spanking their kids as parents who are having trouble managing their kids and using effective discipline. And so all they do is offer them help in getting better control of their kids and their kids' behavior. At the time the Swedish law was passed, it's one of those bits of legislation which, in my fantasy, I have no idea if this is true, was passed when half the members of parliament were away and the other half were asleep at their desk, because it was not generally approved. In fact, newspapers were full of editorials, some newspapers, about how Sweden is going to be a country with kids running wild. Well, that hasn't happened. In fact, since 1979, youth crime rates have gone down precipitously. Drug use rates have gone down. Suicide rates have gone down. Many other things have happened in Sweden since 1979, so you can't attribute it to the decrease in corporal punishment. But at least you can with confidence say that these dire predictions didn't happen.
One last question. I know you've been here talking to us longer than I think you had anticipated.
That's all right.
More than we might have anticipated based on our agenda. But one last question, and I want to know whether your studies, Professor Strauss, look at which type of violence, men's violence perpetrated against women or women's violence perpetrated against men, involves a, you know, greater level of serious physical and emotional consequence.
Yes, I have.
Men's
violence against women has more severe consequences, both physical and emotional. But women's violence against men has substantial. One third of those negative consequences are for violence, are experienced by male victims. Unless you're prepared to say analogous to, well, more people die of heart disease than cancer, so we don't need to worry about cancer, we'll just attend to heart disease. You have to be prepared to say, well, more women are injured, so we are only going to worry about injury to women, not worry about injury to men, even though it's one third of the injuries sustained and one third of the deaths.
I agree. I mean, no violence should be ignored, but I guess my only concern is that, you know, we don't, you know, on a societal level, I mean, I think it's important to recognize that while any degree of violence, female violence perpetrated against men, male violence perpetrated against women, and no matter how you look at it, it's wrong. But I think it is important to keep in mind, as you just pointed out, that the, you know, that male, you know, the two-thirds, you know, male violence perpetrated against women is, you know, has historically more serious effects. And I think it's important that, you know, we as men recognize that it's up to us to work to eliminate not just, you know, female violence against men, but male violence against women. And the male violence against women is the, you know, from what you say, obviously I hate to say a more severe problem, because it's a problem, regardless. I mean, regardless of who perpetrates it, it's a problem. But, you know, it's a more severe problem in a sense.
Sure, just like heart disease is a more severe problem than, say, cancer. I don't know if that's true, but...
Right, but see, the problem is that I think that sometimes if you're focusing on who the people are, who are the perpetrators, and I think that the point of some of this conflict stuff that we see on here is that it doesn't, until you sort of, for me anyway, until you sort of dissect out and say, you know what, this isn't a problem of woman versus, you know, woman being violent to men, men being violent to woman. This is a relationship problem. This is a problem with people not learning the skills to have a equal relationship. Therefore, they try to find a way to control or coerce or dominate, you know, whichever. And until the sexes, until the for example, the violence prevention treatment, the violence prevention programs in high schools become more asexual and focus more on developing, helping kids develop those skills where they can solve conflicts without resorting to being coercive or hitting or whatever it is. I think that's the focus you need to do to try to get at the answer, because otherwise we just end up chasing our tails perpetually. And you know, because if you focus on saying, well, gee, it's a problem, it's a men's problem, because two-thirds of men do it, and it's much more severe, and the injuries are much more severe, and it has a lot of bad effects on women. If you do that, then the focus tends to be away from what the causes are, and more, you know, men are bad, or, you know, whatever it is, and you don't come to anything.
I just want to interject that I don't believe Professor Strauss said two-thirds of men do it. I think he said statistically it was close to 50-50.
Right, I'm sorry. But in terms of the people who are injured.
Although I was confused. You said three times, you know, as serious or two-thirds, one-third. Wouldn't that
no,
be...
No, that's
one,
not right. Correct.
Okay,
that's
wouldn't that be
correct.
One-fourth, three-fourths?
Well, it'd be two-thirds, one-third.
But not if it's three times more than...
You're right. So it's... I guess I get mixed up on this.
It would be twice more.
Twice more.
Oh, good. So
twice more.
Four times. Right. Yeah. Can I just ask two last things? Yeah. One is, how much of these numbers in your studies is New Hampshire or whatever specific?
I'm embarrassed to have to say this, but none of it.
None of it.
Including my U.S. national survey. New Hampshire just isn't big enough to come up in the sampling
Did they do a New Hampshire study? Was it the basis of your 1981 book on a study in New Hampshire?
No. There was, based on the results in that 1980, the one you're thinking of is the 1980 book. Based on that, an enterprising reporter for the Concord Monitor was enterprising after she phoned me. She phoned me and said, well, what about New Hampshire? And I said, well, I'm sorry to say New Hampshire wasn't among the 26 states in this national survey. So she said, could I apply the rates that you found to New Hampshire? And I said, oh, I never thought about that, but that's a good idea. Well, I don't have any reason to think that New Hampshire is going to be that much different. It'll be different in some respects, but in general, we're Americans too, it'll be the same. So what she did was take the rate, the 12% rate in that study, and apply it to the number of coupled households in New Hampshire and come up with an estimate of the number of cases in New Hampshire. And that, she did that, and then she also applied the FBI method. This was a very thoughtful, enterprising reporter. She applied the FBI system of how many occur every minute or every hour to these statistics and came up with the estimate of the number of partner violence incidents that occur every hour, what have you, which ever since then, that got picked up on the AP line, and ever since then, it's appearing over and over again as FBI statistics. The FBI says they never heard of it, which of course they haven't. So, unfortunately, I don't have any New Hampshire data.
What about trends? I mean, where are we 5 years from now?
Well, the trends overall are very positive. Partner violence is decreasing. If you look at... No, it's not in here.
So was it partner mating?
Marriage
rates. The marriage, you know, men and women getting together.
It's not in here. I couldn't put everything in this. But the trends, I did the first National Family Violence Survey in 1975, then in 1985, then in 1992 and 1995. Those are all nationally representative samples. And they show an overall decrease in partner violence rates, 75 to 85 to 95. But when you look at it by gender, it's entirely a decrease in partner violence rates by men, as reported by women. Also as reported by men, but I did it separately to deal with that possible bias. The partner violence rates by women have stayed the same. They have not decreased. And I said, well, if the convergence theory is correct, then I should count my blessings that they haven't increased. With films like Thelma and Louise and what have you, which glorify women thugs, they haven't. And I argue that part of the reason they haven't is that no one's made a big deal about women hitting their partners, whereas we have made a big deal about men hitting, and that was correct, and an important social benefit for everyone of the women's movement. But we should make the same big deal about women hitting men.
How do we make the big deal?
Well, that's what you're... One of the things your commission can help do, for example, if you have an influence on these violence prevention program curricula, if you can get someone to, in the media, for example, to do public service announcements that don't just show an angry young man hitting a woman, but an angry young woman hitting a man, and make that as reprehensible as a man hitting a woman.
When this commission issued its first report, not so long ago, it was a pretty impressive, I thought, report. The efforts of some of the members here, not to single anyone out, certainly, Mike Janolis worked very hard, and it had a lot of good, rich, information in it, and there was a number of recommendations. One of the recommendations was that, this commission, which only has a finite, time period, at least as it stands, and has no budget, at least as it stands, one of the recommendations was that those issues be revisited. When it was picked up by the AP wire, the only thing that was mentioned was Men's Commission seeks money. And it was frustrating, at least for me, because all that good information that went in there, was sort of treated in the media with some irony that all we were looking for was, it just seems like an uphill battle to get these issues, when you say, I was at some department store not too long ago. They're passing out, you contribute a dollar to some program, domestic violence
against women. Yeah.
And when I said, as I was going through the checkout line, kind of in passing, well, what about, women's violence against men? And the reaction was, generally laughter. And one woman said, well, even if it occurs, we all know they're too afraid to report it. And I just, and some of my questions were prompted by some of these experiences, and I'm sort of wondering how we change the focus, emphasis, the primacy. At what point does society begin to say, well, it's not a silly thing, it's not, that women can invade men's space, and walk right up to them, but men can't do that to women. Or, I've had women legislators tell me that men will be telling, off-color jokes, and if they appear, everyone goes silent, and they feel slighted, and they want to hear it too. And there seems to be a fundamental divide. And I just sometimes feel like there's this perceptual wall we run into, where it's not taken seriously.
Well, it is frustrating, and I think what's going to, but on the other hand, the fact that this commission exists is an indication that some things are being done. It's sort of been unheard of 10 years ago. It's going to depend on there being what sociologists call an effective social movement, like the women's movement. It was an uphill battle for women to get the first commission on the status of women established. And they probably sat here or in the equivalent room saying, well, we've had this commission going for 2 years and not much has happened yet. It's going to depend on building a mass of public opinion, and that takes an activist social movement that's starting to emerge as a men's movement, just as a women's movement start to emerge. And it's, I can give you one example of how it's had an effect. When the Congress considered the renewal of the Violence Against Women Act for an additional 5 years, there was a campaign to get them to change the act so that it included violence against men and didn't exclude from services, giving money for services, to services that provide money for men. It included putting up, for example, a great big billboard outside on the road that Senator Biden uses to go from Delaware to Washington every day, chastising him for this biased legislation. and letter writing campaigns. At first I thought it wasn't going to be successful because the committee hearings excluded everyone, excluded me, excluded everyone from testifying unless they were in favor of it. But it got through to the individual members. And the revised legislation has in it a provision that all the provisions of this legislation apply to male victims as well as female victims. Now, whether the administrative staff that administers it, who are convinced, those I know, they're all convinced that this is entirely a male crime and female victimization, some of them won't even speak to me, whether they will administer the law as now written is another question, but the fact that the law got changed is an important thing. And then there's a suit in the courts in California now to require a shelter, I believe in Los Angeles, to provide services for men. So little by little, too little at a time, but things are happening, and it depends on public mobilization, just as the women's movement depended on.
Can I just make a brief comment
on
that? Because I testified in front of the Iowa Committee.
Excuse me.
National Advisory Committee.
Excuse me. There's a couple of things. First, I appreciate Mr. Newman's comments. He's not a member of the commission, and I think this is something that, you know, questions and comments should be limited to members of the commission. And Mr. Newman wants to speak. I mean, he's not on the agenda. And in fact, as I mentioned last meeting, I'm not even sure it's really appropriate for Mr. Newman to sit at the table, which is, I mean, you know, other members of the public, the general public, sit in the public area. In fact, as you recall, even Representative Bickford, a member of the House of Representatives, who was responsible for this commission, sat in the public area until he was asked to sit up at the table with the commission. And so I would respectfully request that the commission ask Mr. Newman to sit, you know, in the back, and at the very least, not to interject without asking for permission from the chair. And that being said, I think what we may want to do as a commission, since there's obviously a lot of discussion that this has engendered, possibly invite Professor Strauss back again after the first of the year to speak with us again, because it is getting to be 23,
right,
which is a fair amount of time beyond...
time well spent.
Absolutely. But we do have other things on the agenda.
Well, I move, if Professor Strauss is willing, that we allow Mr. Newman to pose a question. I mean, we're here to gather useful information, so move that Mr. Newman be allowed to ask the question.
I second that.
In favor?
Yeah.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I have actually probably a lot of discussion I would like to have with you, and we will probably choose another time outside of this commission, Dr. Strauss. But just as far as the VAWA Act, just to just make a comment about that while we're on that subject, and something the commission should be aware of and maybe take some action about, is that, yes, you are correct that we were successful in getting sort of a clause in there recognizing male victims. But for anyone who's read the 467 pages of VAWA, like I have and several others, there is sort of a loophole in that which will allow them administratively to not fund male programs. And that is that they require that in order to apply for VAWA funds for male victims, your program must be a member of your state coalition. And in a case in New Hampshire specifically, a program like ours that serves all victims, including male victims, and reaches out to them to let them know that there is a place where they can sort of not feel uncomfortable, you know, disclosing their abuse, would not be able to apply for that funding, would not be able to get that funding, because the New Hampshire Coalition Against Domestic Violence excludes us from membership. So there's the loophole. That's the issue, is that administratively that act, even though it changed in language, has not really changed in its actual, you know, ability to fund the Bell program. So unfortunately, we made some headway, but not necessarily.
For the record, Mr. Yeah. Chairman, it is my understanding that Mr. Newman actually withdrew his application.
Yes, after many attempts where the coalition denied his
access. You withdrew your application, so it's not that the coalition refused. You simply withdrew your
application. We applied on four different occasions, Mr. Horan, and unless you're really privy to the entire dialogue between us and the coalition, I don't think that you're really adequately prepared to address that.
Be, you know,
I'm willing to submit the letter of withdrawal on the basis for that.
Okay, I just wanted it to be part of the record that it was a withdrawal on your part. You know, it was not a...
Well, after 2.5 years of repeated attempts to become members of the coalition, so I'm sure that you can leave that portion out. I'm not surprised, by the way, at your responses to our program or to Dr. Strauss's research. So,
my response is,
having said that, I don't want to get into personal things, but I think probably Dr. Strauss and I are better off carrying that conversation on at another time.
Dr. Strauss, were you invited to, I guess it was a conference earlier this month at Waterville Valley that all of the domestic violence advocacy groups attend?
No, I was not.
What was the name of that? Dave, you had attended that?
It's the Attorney General's Conference on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
Okay.
Yeah, there
have you ever been invited?
No, there have been several of those. I've never been invited.
Have you ever spoken in front of any of the member groups of the New Hampshire Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence?
No.
So that they could become aware of your research?
They're aware of it,
okay.
But they choose to, at the minimum, ignore it, but typically declare it invalid.
That was my question.
What are you working on now? Can you give us a glimpse of where your research might be taken?
One of the things is the... An issue that you brought up, what's the relationship cross-nationally between equality, the degree of equality in a society, and the rate of partner violence. We haven't yet done that. There's many, many issues. Another one that we're working on actually this month is on multiple victimization, where it's not just physical, but combination of physical, psychological, sexual, and how that, who's doing that, and how, what are its effects as compared to each one of them separately.
Can I ask who funds that?
This is funded by the National Institute of Mental Health.
I'm curious, how much of partner violence...
Despite some vigorous attempts to get NIMH to withdraw their funding.
That you're funded through...
Through research grants.
But through the next year?
Well, through the next year we have a grant application pending for an additional 5 years, whether...
Yeah.
You never know.
How much partner dominance do you think is hardwired, nature versus the product of social environment?
Well,
nature?
I'm one of those few sociologists who think that almost any aspect of human behavior is partly biologically determined. But my fellow sociologists haven't yet excommunicated me for that. But I take it as the job of the sociologist to investigate the part that isn't hardwired, just like it's the job of biological scientists to investigate the part that is, and best of all, when there's a collaboration, to look at how the two interact with each other to produce actual behavior. Science is a funny thing. It depends to a considerable extent on departing from reality by dissecting the parts, but it also depends on putting the parts back together to get a whole picture. That's more difficult in a certain sense.
Okay.
Well, I think I really do have to. Yeah, it's quarter. Dying here.
This is intensely interesting.
Yeah,
I think we'll provide a question regarding the link between us and the primates.
Maybe we'd better put that off for another time when I'm here. Because
missing. Or certainly, then just let me ask my bit about where do you think we should put most of our focus on the causes or the effects? I mean, I know there's a 2-to-1 or a 3-to-1 ratio on the effect side of it, but there's like a 50-50 split on the causes side of it. And I know Lauren rightfully agrees we should concentrate more on the tendency of women to have violations.
With all due respect, Commissioner Lauren or David,
okay.
Not Warren. I don't call you Genoa. So.
Oh, I'm sorry. It would be quicker if you did it at all. I wouldn't mind. But yes, my manners need to be addressed. I'm sorry.
That's okay, Mike. Apology accepted.
Councilman, inferior background. What I would like to know is where should we put most of our effort in the causes of this or the...
That's one of those impossible
things.
I mean, obviously, both need attention, and we've talked this afternoon about both. We've talked about prevention, which is dealing with the causes in the form of high school programs and university programs that are unbiased. So that's on the causes side, that's very important. And then services, we've talked about that. There may not be as many men who need help and services, but there's plenty. So that needs to also be addressed. And I would, you know, I'm hard put to say which it is. Maybe it depends on where you think you've got them. A leverage, a strategic decision based on where you might do something.
Well, thank you very much. We'll be certain to invite you back. Just let Dr. Kluda have some contact with you, and certainly Scott will communicate to you our email addresses and some of the specific requests and things that we would like to look at.
Okay.
But I think it's very illuminating at times.
Thank you.